Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. My guest for this episode is Robert Couric, a landscape designer and author whose books have been influential on permaculture through the years. Some of his titles include Designing and Maintaining Your Edible Landscape Naturally, Roots Demystified, and Drip Irrigation for Every Landscape and All Climates. Find out more about Mr. Couric and his work at robertcouric.com. You'll find a link to his site in the show notes. Our conversation looks at how landscape design has changed over the years, moving towards more sustainability, while also looking at the practical aspects of design and meeting a customer's needs. That in turn leads to some thoughts on practicing permaculture. Throughout, Mr. Couric includes references to his own research and experience over the years, including some of the technical details. If you enjoy this or any other episode of the show, please consider making a donation and help grow the possibilities of this podcast. You can find out how at thepermaculturepodcast.com/support. Now then, on to the interview with Mr. Couric. I'll join you again afterwards with further thoughts and updates. Then, Robert, if you're ready, could you give us a little bit of your biography and background and how you came to be a garden writer?
Well, actually, I started in the field. I call it the School of Hard Knocks. In 1975, when I started landscape maintenance, there was a drought. And so I started with graywater systems back in 1975. In 1978 or so, I installed my first edible landscape. Then I became quite well known for edible landscaping. So I moved in 1980 to the Fairlawn Institute Rural Center in Occidental, California. And I taught a six-week course on edible landscaping and a number of other workshops. And that brings me up to the time that in 1986 I published my book on edible landscaping.
And then you've just continued to do your work and develop more information for people who want to build their edible landscapes?
Yes, basically I talk and write about what I've done as opposed to journalism, or so to speak. So like when I did my drip irrigation book, I had been installing the types of drip irrigation I recommend for over 15 years.
How did you get into doing edible landscape design and installation?
Well, I had a client back in 1976 or so who wanted some vegetables and herbs for their kitchen. And what I did was I said, okay, let's integrate it in a way that's appealing instead of just a block of stuff. So I built a retaining wall out of used brick, and it was in visible sight right in direct line from the kitchen window. So she could look outside the kitchen window and see what was growing and determine what she wanted to harvest for that day's meals. So that was the very first one. And then about 2 years later, I had a client that wanted a very extensive edible landscape because the husband was very ill and had to eat nothing but raw vegetables and raw foods. And he wanted the raw vegetables as fresh as possible. And the garden itself was completely visible from their dining room, and the back door of the kitchen went straight to the garden. So I try to get things as close as possible to the house. So in my edible landscaping book, I say you should never plant vegetables any further than can throw the kitchen sink. I made the mistake of not realizing that there are now aluminum sinks, so you can throw them much further than the old porcelain sinks.
And I was thinking the other side of that, that you give that recommendation to someone who's a shot putter or someone like that.
Right. That's true.
Since that time in the beginning of having that handful of clients who wanted an edible landscape, how has your edible landscape design and implementation changed?
It's changed not a whole lot. I first designed edible landscapes where the major components worked as an ecological whole. In other words, I had the vegetables in one area in a dense planting with herbs like at the ends of the boxes to kind of mask the architecture of the boxes so they didn't look so rigid. And then nearby, for one client, I planted a very nice wildflower garden of which there were plants I knew that attracted beneficial insects. Now, the client didn't know about those plants because they would not have understood what I was talking about in 1978. So I knew they were there, but they knew it was a very attractive wildflower garden, and it was done without irrigation so it wouldn't hurt the oak tree that it was around. So the other components like trees get separated in a slight area close to but not in the vegetables. But the trees I plant in groves, they're planted in irregular spacings, so they look more like a forest than a typical orchard where there are all these linear lines, because you don't need that in a home setting because you're not using tractors.
So through this process on the back end, kind of behind the scenes, you're including things like integrated pest management, water harvesting, and various other ecological services, but kind of hiding them from your customers?
Certain things get hidden in the sense I don't justify them for the ecological aspects. I justify them for the financial capabilities so they can save money. Now, for example, I've never done a cistern because we don't get any rain the entire summer for months. And if you try to calculate out the type of cistern you need to maintain even a small vegetable garden through the whole summer, it gets very expensive. So in that case, I use drip irrigation mulches and that sort of thing to utilize the water in the most effective way I can.
I'm thinking about that and the different designs that you've done and trying to keep them close. How large of an edible landscape have you designed and implemented productively?
They're actually a little bit on the small side because the homeowner has a regular job and has to pay the rent or the mortgage, so that the one I did in 1978 was about 40 by 60. I've never done one bigger than like 50 by 80 design-wise. I stopped installing landscapes in 1984 in order to focus on writing my edible landscape book. So I've continued to design edible landscapes since then. But they don't tend to be that large because the homeowner can't keep up with them. In other words, I don't plant a lot of fruit trees because they can't come home from work and spend hours and hours canning. But one thing I do to try to minimize that is I have multiple graft trees. So like I have an apple tree that has 8 varieties of apples on it. They ripen at different times during the season. So you can harvest to eat as you eat your way around the tree, so to speak. And you're not deluged by 500 pounds of Gravenstein apples all at once.
So through your design, you're really trying to meet the needs of your clients in a functional way that they can actually eat and use what's coming out of their garden.
Right. Example would be if they wanted a vine like a grape, I would not grow it up a tree because it's too hard for them to understand what to do, and the grapes get too high off the ground in a short order to make it easy to harvest. So the grapes would be either in a trellis situation or what we call head grape pruning, where they're individual trunks, not on a trellis. And the individual trunks, the head pruning, tends to look more natural.
And then these different techniques and strategies that you developed over the years allow you to kind of fit more into the landscape in a way that's still aesthetically pleasing?
Yes. One example would be like marigolds. Marigolds, people think of as attracting lots of beneficial insects, but they don't do really that great of a job. But I put some in there because the client likes the color and they're a long season of bloom. Now, if I wanted to use marigolds to help take care of nematodes in the soil, it's only one specific type of marigold. It's not the one that people are used to buying for ornamental purposes. And it's a specific type that has to be planted as a monocrop because the roots exude a chemical that forces the nematodes out of the soil. So it can't be integrated with vegetables. It has to be done in rotation with vegetables. So sometimes things are not physically side by side. And in my edible landscaping book, I have a chart. I think it's 50, 60, 70 examples of companion plantings that do not work based on scientific studies at universities with control plots versus companion planting plots. So in very few cases does the plant have to be physically next to the plant that they say is going to protect. So that's why I can have ornamental flower borders that have the types of plants that help attract beneficial insects. And then those insects can migrate or fly many, 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 many feet to find the pests in the vegetables themselves. So there's a lot of myth about edible landscaping gardening, and one of the biggest ones is companion planting.
And a lot of that myth is just because of the gardening wisdom that gets repeated over the years versus the evidence for what actually works.
Right. It's a problem where you have an anecdotal situation where somebody grew, let's say, marigolds with their beans, and they said, oh, I didn't have any bean beetles. Well, one, they're in one particular spot of the country, and two, maybe that season they were lucky and there weren't any beetles. So it gets replicated in these books as if it was universal. So Rodale Press did a study of marigolds adjacent in rows to bean plants, and they found that the marigolds reduced the amount of bean beetles coming to the plant and eating on the foliage, but the control plant had more production. The control plot with no marigolds produced more beans because marigolds exude a chemical that tends to stunt the growth of other plants around it. It's a competitive strategy to favor their own growth, so that the marigolds were stunting the plants that were growing next to them. So even though, although there were reductions in the bean beetles, the plants still produced less beans. And that was done by Rodale Press, and as far as I know, they've never corrected their information. In other words, in the past, it showed up after those studies. It didn't show up in Organic Gardening magazine. There's another type of edible landscaping where they mix everything together. And it can be done in very, very ornamental, very attractive ways. But if you have a handful of lettuces mixed in amongst some ornamental plants, especially perennials, a lot of times the client doesn't see the lettuce until it's gone to seed, and then it's too bitter to eat. So I found that having a little bit of visual separation makes it easier for the client to take care of the overall scene. And also, let's take example of a friend of mine put in a rainbow garden of lettuces. So there were arcs of lettuces, each a different color, to sort of mimic a rainbow. So they take really nice photos, and they look wonderful in the books and the magazine articles, but they're never eaten. And if you were to eat that garden, you would destroy the design. So that in some cases, it's important to have perennial elements in amongst or near the planting to compensate for the fact that you're actually going to eat some of the food. So my approach is different than, there's a lot of books out now on versions of Eat Your Lawn, Edible Landscaping, other titles, and they tend to mix everything together, some of them. That tends to be problematic in my experience with real-life clients. It's different than somebody has an incredible edible landscape themselves and is a very good gardener and is compulsive about gardening. Then they can do a book that's very attractive, but it doesn't necessarily follow that the average homeowner or renter or what have you, gardener, can mimic that kind of intensity or complex design.
It really takes a hands-on gardening approach in order to try to do that kind of mixed integration.
Right. And they can be done very attractive. Some of my friends in the industry, so to speak, do extremely ornamental edible landscapes. Over the years, they have tended to start to isolate the vegetables into blocks. Or in our area, we have to have the vegetables in raised boxes because we need to put a wire bottom, because gophers will eat almost any vegetable plant you put in the ground. So to protect the plants from gophers, we do raised beds of some fashion with hard sides and the wire bottom. So they might be 12 to 24 inches tall. They might be wood. They might be metal. They might be brick. But the main thing is we can't afford to plant out large arcs of lettuces because the gophers will just come along and destroy the lettuces.
And then by doing the raised beds in order to make them a depth that could be harvested, you have some limitations of space then as well?
Yeah. Basically, we tend to try to do a rotation crop, teach the client how to plant the corn in one spot and then follow it by beans the next year and things like that, so there's less stress on the soil. But the important part from a design point of view is I don't like the architecture, so to speak, visually of an angular wooden box. So I plant perennial herbs in the corners to drape over the box, such as edible and ornamental thymes, or variegated thyme, which is attractive and edible. And then what I do, I have one design where it's been there for 40 years now, it's still being used, and that's where one side, they're on a lawn looking at the boxes, and the boxes have the plants in the corners, but there's an ornamental hedge of lavender along the front side, so that when you look at the boxes from the lawn, you don't see the angles of the architecture close to the lavender. And the lavender hedge also obscures the drip irrigation lines that come up into the box, so that everything is ornamental as opposed to just architectural.
I'm imagining what that would look like and the way that would break up the lines.
What I did in this particular garden is, since I try to avoid the angular nature of some of these beds, is I put the beds in an arc so that they were planted in an arc. And they wanted not symmetry, they wanted an asymmetrical garden. So to the left side of the front door, the arc radius is a different number of feet than the radius to make the arc on the right side of the door. So there's lots of subtle ways. The person standing in the lawn looking at this arc of lavender in front of beds laid out in the arc wouldn't be able to tell visually that there's two different radius, but subconsciously I believe there is a little bit more response to the fact that it's not completely symmetrical.
And these kinds of ideas about this kind of hiding these edges and design magic is covered in your Edible Landscape book?
Well, the Edible Landscape book was done in I wrote it from 82 to 86. And it summed up what I was doing there. It has photographs of the garden I did in 1978, and more of the angles show up in that garden, but mostly because the site was very steep and very limited, so we had to use raised beds because of the terracing that we had to do. But the Edible Landscaping book is basically a maintenance and design manual for how things work, as opposed to how to put things together visually. Done lots of articles about putting things together visually, but people use my Edible Landscaping book as a reference a lot, and it's used as secondary or recommended reading in permaculture courses all over the world, because it's considered by some people one of the better permaculture books, even though it was written in 86 and doesn't use the word permaculture because it didn't exist then, so to speak.
But many of the ideas and principles that you were putting into place within your book run parallel to the ideas of permaculture.
Right. Like in one tiny drawing, I have a swale and a berm that shows you how to develop drainage for a swale and a berm and how you can do that in a serpentine pattern. So it's a nice visual attracting way of draining soil and keeping the plants that are sensitive to root rot on the higher part of the berm. In another drawing, it's a small drawing in the book, it shows how to grow vegetables on top of a hay bale. Well, hay bale gardening is one of the hottest things going right now, but I did it in 1976. And I got the idea not from myself, but from researching in the library, and I found a book from England, and they did hay bale gardening in greenhouses so that they could grow the whole crop in the greenhouse, and then at the end of the season, push all the straw and plant material out of the greenhouse and Clorox the concrete floor. So they're able to sterilize the greenhouse by growing things on hay bales because it was easy to clean them out. So I didn't invent the hay bale gardening, but I was one of the first people to ever recommend it.
It's pretty interesting to hear how you intersect all these different pieces of the gardening and permaculture community, as someone who didn't come to any of this until much later.
Funny thing, a friend of mine is a good friend who's very involved in permaculture and is quite knowledgeable. And he wasn't born when I published the Edible Landscaping book. So that a lot of people are discovering it now. And even though it was published in 86, it's still in print. So it's still valued by a number of people and it continues to sell.
Well, I can say that I was not aware of your book until it was brought to my attention to one of my listeners, but I'm thankful that he did. because of the different pieces of this that will be very useful to others who are doing this kind of design work. As a permaculture practitioner, one of the places that I come from is that many of the designs are trying to mimic nature, but that nature mimicry isn't necessarily appealing to someone who wants a ornamental garden, but wants to use the ideas of permaculture and some of the ecosystem services that can be provided by such a garden as an ornamental design in their landscape. And that kind of bridging that gap and moving towards something that can be permaculturally functional while also ornamental.
Well, when I did something that was a little bit similar to food forest back in 78, I found that integrating a lot of the stuff was a pain because you had to avoid stepping on the strawberries in order to prune or harvest the plums. And so that a lot of this emphasis on food forest right now troubles me because two things. One, the physical direct integration of plant material can make it very difficult for the average homeowner to maintain. And there's also an emphasis on perennial foods because in a forest, in a New England forest, you don't have very many annual foods, so to speak. But in other areas of the country, you do. So a lot of these gardening books are based from people who live in a temperate, sort of like New England forest. And that's not at all like we have in California with some areas. We have a lot of chaparral, and we have a different type of ecosystem altogether. So the people who recommend perennial vegetables are very interesting people. I like the idea of more perennial vegetables because it cuts down the maintenance to some degree. But to integrate directly amongst the plants is difficult for the average homeowner. Most of these people have eaten salads and hamburgers. You know what I mean? I don't know anybody that lives off of perennial vegetables. And so that there's got to be a little bit more give, I think, to make it realistic.
And that's where I think it's important for a lot of these ideas is to get the buy-in of the people who are going to use the systems, especially in trying to do a lot of transition to explore some more of these currently experimental ideas, such as food forests, that if someone's going to let us install it on their property to ensure that what's being planted is something that they will eat, as well as providing the knowledge and education to go with it on how to do the maintenance.
Yeah, there's a lot of very advanced, very good gardeners doing forest farming or experimenting with it. And they're doing a good job of what I would call ecological beauty. In other words, someone like me would look at the garden and say, oh, there's a lot of environmental, ecological, dynamic aspects to this planting. But the homeowner doesn't see that. And so there's got to be a transition. And a lot of times I've seen permaculture people come in and inflict, so to speak, their preconceived notions of what should be there, a certain amount of swales, certain amount of harvest plants for the chickens, a cistern, even though it's not cost-effective in California. So they have a set of tools that may not be adapted to every environment, but because they're teaching the same stuff everywhere, and the books are geared towards, like the design books by Bill Mollison, are geared to everything from tropical to desert, it's hard for the average homeowner to pick out what is a temperate example, and then how to integrate that in a way that fits their lifestyle, which may be very different than having grapes crawl up a plum tree.
From my perspective, I'd rather have someone have a nice annual vegetable garden in their front yard and teaching them about mulching strategies and other things to conserve water and some of the other pieces that come from the principles and strategies of permaculture than rather to try to, well, I don't want them to meet me where I am, but to meet them where they're at and what they're capable of.
That's excellent. And with a lot of people who take permaculture classes get so enthusiastic that they go out and they have a bias or what I'm trying to say, where they have a prejudice towards what they learn in the class, and they try to impose that more than they try to listen to the client. So in the back of my edible landscaping book, there's about an 8-page survey to try to get information from the client as to what's realistic for them, what their soils are like, how much you'll have to burn plants to prevent root rot, things like that.
You touch on one of the things that I'm kind of working through as a mental model practicing permaculture professionally and how to make that transition from this very empowering perspective that permaculture provides to being able to practice within the society that exists right now and to meet clients where they are so that their needs are satisfied.
Right. I use the example of pruning. Alex Shigo, Dr. Shigo, or Shigo, I forget how you pronounce it, spent years analyzing how to prune and realized that you don't cut flush to the trunk. You cut at a small flight angle. And it's taken decades for the average homeowner now to not prune flush. And if you still go around to some nurseries, every once in a while you'll find somebody that's pruning flush to the trunk. Well, the same thing's going to happen with all the permaculture ideas. It's going to take decades to integrate. Edible landscaping took over 10 years to become, quote, popular. The first time I realized it was mainstream, I saw a cartoon. Two women were talking over the neighbor's fence, and there's these two guys on the ground on their hands and knees. And the women were talking about, these guys must be doing an edible landscape. So the phrase was there. It was a pretty funny interpretation. But that took like 10 years. So that I think we need a more realistic time frame, and it's going to be lifetime work.
We're really just kind of moving through the first generation of this knowledge?
Yeah, I say second or third. In 1980, we hosted Bill Mollison in the first talk he ever gave in America on permaculture. And we had him do a few short seminars over around the Bay Area at that time. At that time, he had a different focus on permaculture. And he came through the second time about, I don't know, it was 3-4 years later. And he had a big focus on what we call sheet mulching now. And people got crazy about sheet mulching back in the late 80s, early 90s. So each time he came through was a different generation. So I think we're on a third or fourth or fifth generation, depending on how you look at it. But yet it's fascinating that when he was proposing sheet mulching in the 90s or early, late 80s, it's taken till now for it to become very popular.
That movement through time and change of focus makes me... I interviewed Dave Jackie recently.
Right.
And he made the comment that, you know, he's been doing this for 30-some years now, and that during the 80s, you had to have an herb spiral in order for it to be permaculture.
Right, exactly.
And like, you know, that was the 80s fad for permaculture, and now that it seems like everybody's doing hugelkultur as the latest fad.
Back in 85, I put together a mound system where I used the chips from a tree service that had a lot of shredded leaves and shredded bark and shredded wood, and I piled them 4 feet high and covered them with 6 inches of native soil, and then I planted directly into the soil, and I planted in the fall, and I never irrigated again. 25 years later, things are still growing, but they started out growing very well because it was what people now call, hugelkultur, but I was using chips as opposed to logs, but this concept is quite similar.
It seems like the more that enters the literature, the more that it's been done before.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of roots. When I was a landscaper doing maintenance and installation, I would have things I called inspiration or insight or intuitive. But I went to the libraries in Berkeley, the horticultural and agricultural libraries. We didn't have the internet then. So I crawled around in the back of the libraries. They would let you go into the stacks and look for books that nobody had ever seen. And that's where I ran across the book on hay bale gardening from England. That's where I ran across the book from Mrs. O'Brien from England that talks about surface cultivation. So it was an intermediate step between garden cultivation and no cultivation, no till. And so it was, I've been putting that in my book. I put that in my book in 86, and I've put it in articles and books ever since because it's just now starting for people to realize that they can make the transition from deep cultivation, so to speak, to surface cultivation where you're just skimming the crowns of the weeds off. You're not actually forking the soil. And then now it's getting more popular than with no-till methods.
It's gotten to the point there's a local farming newspaper, Lancaster Farming, here in Pennsylvania. And I've watched over the last couple of years as it's moved more and more towards sustainable agriculture and looking at options like no-till and cover cropping, and even getting rather technical in the amount of like nitrogen you can integrate from cover cropping, the amount of organic matter that you need to add per acre in order to increase the organic material by 1%. And 5 years ago, when I first sat down and looked at my wife's subscription, none of that information was in there. And it's interesting to see this progression.
Yeah, and back in the early 70s and into the mid or 80s or early 90s, the vineyards around here cultivated everything to dust mulch every year. And now we see sod culture as being almost prevalent, where at least half of the rows are in sod culture that's mowed. And that was considered verboten back in the 80s. It was never done. I might add that there's a chart I have in my edible landscaping book about nitrogen fixation, and it shows what crops can be grown based on what nitrogen is fixed by the cover crop. In other words, soybeans are very poor at generating nitrogen, and there's almost no vegetable you can grow in a rotation with soybeans to keep the vegetable happy with nitrogen, whereas alfalfa, it makes so much nitrogen that you can grow just about anything in a rotation and not have to import manure.
Is your book on edible landscaping, has that been revised or updated since you first wrote it?
No, I did it in 86. It took 4 years to produce and extreme amount of personal stress and a whole lot of money. It was done before there were page layout programs. It was done when the word processing was a little floppy disk, and we thought a 10 megabyte hard disk was beyond belief and would never be filled up. So that I don't have anything on disk. I would have to actually hand enter the entire book of what I'm going to use into a Word document and then work on a page layout program. So it's inconceivable to me to update it. What I do is articles. So I've done over 100 articles over the years at different magazines and try to kind of update things that way.
So you still continue to add to the knowledge base from that book, but that book itself will not at this time receive an update because of the work required to recreate it.
Yeah, yeah, it's unfortunate, but it's true. And so in other words, there's a very little mention of drip irrigation in the edible landscape book. But then in 93, during another drought, I produced the only book for home gardeners exclusively on drip irrigation. There are other books that have drip irrigation as a chapter, but my book is the only one where the entire book is geared towards drip irrigation. But that was a subset, a very tiny subset of the edible landscaping book, and became a whole book. And there are root drawings in the edible landscaping book that now have been fleshed out to an entire book, the Roots Demystified book. So I take basic concepts and expand them. In other words, in my drip irrigation book, I talk about drip irrigation can increase yields even though it's saving water. But I did an e-book that's 100 pages that has 36 citations of where drip irrigation increased the yields compared to other irrigation, even though it was using less water. And then I have text about how does that happen. And so I've taken that small bit of information from the drip irrigation book and expanded into 100 pages for a new book.
And I'm seeing here, looking on your website, that your drip irrigation is in its second edition and now 187 pages?
Yes. So I did have, because that book was done with a computer back in 93, we were able to use most of the drawings and add, I think I added 17 new drawings or so. And I added quite a few number of pages, and I added a chapter on cisterns and a chapter on gray water. And so that is a revised second edition, and I was able to do that. And if I want to, I could do the same thing with the Roots book because it's all on computer.
That's an interesting way to do it. Now I realize how fortunate we are these days to have these systems to store data and information. And
well, you know what I had to do to research things in the Ag Library took me hour and a half to get there from where I live, hours and hours in the library, and an hour and a half to drive back home, whereas we sit on the internet, do a Google search, and it's all done.
I think about that as a student. My first, when I was doing my undergrad work, it was still a lot of going to the library because the internet was still kind of nascent and growing. And now I can go to, as you say, Google, there's, what is it, Google Scholar, and type in something that I'm interested in, and then have a list of all the references for that keyword.
Right. But I must mention that there are still entire books, articles, and research papers that are not on the Internet. In other words, it furthers the research to take a paper that you like and call up the person that wrote the paper and expand upon the information based on that discussion. And also it furthers things to get a paper, let's say it has 106 citations at the end of it or something, read through them and find the two or three that seem to be maybe appropriate and find those papers. But a lot of times, they won't be on the Internet. You have to go to the library, at an agricultural library, and find the journal and find the year and page number for that reference.
It's where I feel fortunate to live where I do, because of our one local library has a wing with reference librarians that you can go and ask questions of, and they can point you to the journals and order in many of those pieces and help you find this information.
Yeah, it's great. And then I use interlibrary loans as well.
There was an author who I spoke to who works with foraging, and part of the conversation that we had was the quality of information that you can find in a well-referenced book versus just doing a Google search and reading the first web page you find.
Right. And so sometimes I go 3, 4, 5 pages into the search, and it takes a lot of time, but I'll find pieces of information that don't show up on the first page at all.
And those sources back to those journal articles that you can't find online that you can then go look up and find that original research.
Right, exactly. Or in some cases, I get a interlibrary loan of the book that it references. So like I live in Northern California, and I've gotten a number of books from the libraries in L.A. on agroforestry and other topics where I had ran across the fact that one chapter seemed very interesting. But of course, a chapter is not available on the Internet, so I had to get the book.
It was something that Dave Jackie and I talked about, and it's the herbalist and author Stephen Herod Buhner referred to the idea of a citizen scientist, that people who want to advance the knowledge that we have to be willing to go out and do the research, but also to actually refer to the journals and the other literature in order to have something that is a solid piece of researched information to add to the library so that it doesn't become self-referential.
Right. You have to expand upon intuition and experience and add depth to it, I think. And so when I did my ebook on how is it that drip irrigation increases yield, I think I've got 36 citations, but there's over 100 examples within those citations. So you can look up just about anything you want. It's got the reference for each. Like when it says the chilies in India, the increase was 48%. The production, even using only 38% of the water. And then I give you the journal where I got that information. So it takes some research to back up what we might be doing instinctively.
I like that idea that you presented of using your insight or intuition as a place to start. That aha moment of, you know, this seems pretty interesting, but then going out and finding more information. It's, as a permaculture practitioner, one of the walls that I run up against is having conversations with research scientists.
Right.
Sometimes it's a little dismissive. As I've said to some, I find that it's easier to say that I'm a graduate student and get a door opened than it is to mention permaculture. And I don't know if that's just some of the baggage that permaculture has right now.
Well, it's not so much baggage, I think, as it's an older generation. It's a generational shift. In other words, only now is the word permaculture showing up occasionally, I think, in the Association of Landscape Architecture literature. But I know a woman tried to get me and
Eric Tonesmeyer.
They tried to get me and him and a couple other people to be on a panel discussion of food forests for the American Society of Landscape Architecture yearly conference, and it went nowhere. So there's occasional mention of the word now, but there's not any understanding of the concept, and they don't do anything in the conferences.
Locally, a lot of the organizations that I'm involved with deal with agriculture, and one of them is the Pennsylvania Association for Sustainable Agriculture, and permaculture is now showing up at their conferences.
Oh, okay.
Seeing the things that they were presenting 5 years ago, 6 years ago, that are now showing up in the, if you will, mainstream agriculture newspaper. I wonder if it's just another 5 years or so until that moves another step here locally. It'll be interesting to watch that.
Right. Like my Roots Demystified book came out 5 years ago, I think, and it talked about, you know, the roots of trees are 80-90% are the top 12 to 6 inches. Only now are the master gardeners beginning to teach people what that is and how what that means of how you garden. So they're using my book as a reference in courses on master gardener courses. And so that I've been lucky in the sense that my intuition of what topics should be discussed tends to precede the mainstream. And so I can kind of like, not monopolize, but get a lot of track record off of that in sales, book sales.
And I realize here, looking at your Roots Demystified, that I believe that I've seen some of these drawings or something similar in some of my local material. Certainly getting out there, and it's being more prevalently understood.
Right. And so like the Edible Forest Gardens book has very good drawings, and it's the first time a book has ever had an illustration on the cover that shows that the roots go mostly sideways, not very deep, and as opposed to everybody thinks it's only tap roots on trees.
Yeah, that was something that I just learned recently, is the many of the tap roots wind up dying back once the side roots have become established.
Exactly. Like oak trees in California, the native oaks, acorns, they might have a leafy green above the soil of 4 inches, but the roots might be 38, 48 inches deep. But then over time, the lateral root system develops, and that's what becomes sustaining to the tree over long term, and the taproot is no longer needed, and does wither and die or get sort of like choked off.
I have a lot of conversation with my children when I have them out, both in our own backyard and some of the other places we go locally, because we've had some flooding cause some erosion, and it's revealed a lot of those lateral roots. My son sees them and thinks that it's a piece of rope that's laying there, and he goes to grab one. It's like, no, that's the root for the tree. We don't want to tear that up.
Right. Well, I'm always looking for roadside excavations, you know, where they cut a road, or along the coast of the ocean where the erosion of the ocean has revealed root systems. So I'm doing a similar thing that you're doing.
Robert, you've covered so many things that I was interested in talking with you about. I really liked all the examples that you provided of your work and how these pieces tie together, especially over time, and how we're seeing these different techniques come to the forefront with the work that we're doing on the ground to implement more sustainable gardens. So thank you for your time and joining me and sharing all that. But before we bring this to a close, is there anything else that you would like to add to the conversation for the listeners?
Well, I think it's more reiteration that the biggest task I face still and other people face is listening to the client and trying to determine what they can and can't do. Like, there's no client that I've ever met that can graft fruit trees. So they have to hire somebody, but you don't want to integrate multiple grafted fruit trees unless you have a resource that'll do that for the client. So it's really important to listen and understand the client's capabilities. And so I think that's still something I'm trying to learn.
And that's something that each of us will have to learn moving forward, to know where we come from in order to have those conversations and to ask the right questions.
Right. In other words, everybody's not going to want a hookah culture. It's a very important technique, but the homeowner would be appalled by the process of making one, I think.
We as designers may not always be available to our clients. So even though we may try to design ourselves out of the design, that may not always be applicable to the person who is hiring us to do that work.
Right. Some people go so far as to say that they can walk away from the landscape and the food will continue to be produced. That's far from reality. I don't know anybody that doesn't have a lot of maintenance to do on their permaculture or edible landscape or food garden.
From some of the other pieces that we had that didn't make it into this interview, that's a conversation that I'd like to follow up with you sometime. So once this interview is out, if it's okay with you, I'll leave the floor open for listeners to ask questions based on this conversation and some of the realities of doing this work on the ground. And then we can do a follow-up sometime in the near future.
That'd be great.
And that was Robert Couric. One of my favorite thoughts from this conversation is his notion to not inflict ourselves on clients. that we can't go in with preconceived notions of what techniques to use. I think that goes back to the thought of it depends, as shared with us by Dave Jackie and so many others, when asked what to do with a particular site for any given client. There is no one way to do this. There is no universal technique or strategy. What is inherently universal about permaculture are the ethics and principles that lead to on-the-ground ideas. By observing the landscape, interacting with a client, and developing small and slow solutions, we can use our expertise to meet the needs of others. And if we want to meet their needs, we need to meet them where they're at. What are your thoughts on building and designing a better world? I'd love to hear from you. Give me a call, 717-827-6266, or send me an email, show@thepermaculturepodcast.com. If you'd like to join in the discussions and get updates, be sure to like the show on Facebook at facebook.com/thepermaculturepodcast, and follow me on Twitter, where I am @permaculturecst. Coming up next week is Bob Tice, who returns to continue the conversation about natural building, and the last episode of this month will be Larry Santoyo. Larry and I had a good time discussing permaculture in many different ways. Until the next time, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other, and the legal. The Permaculture Podcast is released under Creative Commons, Attribution, No Derivatives, Non-Commercial License. Feel free to share it, just tell people where you got it from, and don't change or sell it.